The Guitar Quintet No. 2 in E Major by Luigi Boccherini, guitarist Pepe Romero, joined by players from the Academy Chamber Ensemble.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Laird Scranton. Laird Scranton. Mr. Scranton is an independent researcher of ancient cosmology and language. His studies in comprehensive cosmology have helped synchronize aspects of ancient African, Egyptian, Vedic, Chinese, Polynesian, and other world cosmologies, and have led to an alternative approach to reading Egyptian hieroglyphic words. His degree is in English from Vassar College. He became interested in Dogon mythology and symbolism in the early 1990s. He has studied ancient myth, language, and cosmology since 1997 and has been a lecturer at Colgate University. He also appears in John Anthony West's Magical Egypt DVD series. His writings include books and articles published or taught by Colgate University, Temple University, and the University of Chicago. Now, you might ask, what does this have to do with UFOs, cosmology? And I ask you to think about the strange symbols reported to be on the surface of UFOs, as well as those reported to be on their interior by alleged abductees. So, let's explore that potential connection today. Welcome to the show, Laird.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. Let's see. So we're talking about cosmology here. So first give our listeners the Reader's Digest explanation of the science of cosmology.
Okay, what I basically do is I try to learn more about ancient symbols and myths and rituals by comparing how different cultures who share the same myths and rituals understand their own practices.
Right.
And so my series of books has been a way of trying to synchronize the creation traditions of ancient cultures by through these comparisons. Language is a very important part of it. So I was very fortunate that my entry point into this work was through an African tribe called the Dogon, who are a controversial tribe. Robert Temple wrote a book about the Dogon tribe in 1975 called The Serious Mystery that was a very popular book. That the Dogon tribe is a good place to start because their culture is sort of spans three or four different ancient sets of traditions. They have some traditions like Judaism, some things like ancient Egypt, some things like Buddhism. So it makes a good jump-off point for comparing to other cultures.
Very good. So you say Dogon. Now, I mentioned Dogon. What are the Dogon peoples?
Yeah, the Dogon are a modern-day primitive African tribe, meaning that they don't have access to technology. Mm-hmm. They live in a very remote region of Mali in Africa. This is in the northwest hump sort of Africa. Mm-hmm. And they live in a desert region that is about an eight-hour drive across, you know, lands with nothing in it, about as remote as you can get from modern technology. But they have a very clear sense that they are a priestly tribe, and they have a very clear sense of what their symbols and myths and traditions represent. Mm-hmm. And their priority is on preserving purity of language and purity of symbols.
Okay. Symbols. Now, are petroglyphs synonymous with cosmology?
Petroglyphs are an aspect of it. When we talk about cosmology, in the ancient sense, what they meant when they said cosmology, they were talking about how the processes of creation happen. Mm-hmm. And when they say that, we're talking about three things sort of simultaneously. We're talking about how matter forms, how the universe forms, and how the processes of biological reproduction happen.
Okay.
Those three themes of creation were seen as so similar to one another that this system of symbols that I'm pursuing actually defines all three processes using a single progression of symbols, that every symbol has meaning for each of those three themes. For example, the shape of a hemisphere, if we're talking about biological reproduction, represents a womb.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the formation of matter, it represents the expansion of mass as atoms form.
Okay. Okay, so all of this can be found in this cosmology.
Yes. The Dogon priests flatly say that their symbols describe how a tribal god named Amma created matter. And this is one of the things that intrigued me initially, was I could see that they had the definition of an atom correct, and they had definitions of protons, electrons, and neutrons that make up atoms correct. And they even had a corresponding drawing that looked like the one of the typical orbital patterns that an electron makes with an atom. And so I asked myself, not knowing very much about the structure of matter at that time, I said, well, gee, if they have these topmost structures right, what are the chances that this whole descending structure they describe might also be right?
Mm-hmm.
And I started exploring it and realized not only is it right, you can lay it side by side with popular explanations of how matter forms from people like Brian Greene and Stephen Hawking, and it's intuitively a match from atom down to waves.
Now, how old are these symbols, these Dogon symbols? When were these, are these on rocks? Are they on...
This is really an oral tradition.
Okay.
And it's supported by drawings that the Dogon priests say that they are not capable of talking about a concept without also drawing it at the same time. I'm sort of that way myself. They use sticks to draw pictures in the sand while they're talking about these things.
Okay.
And there were a set of French anthropologists who spent 30 years documenting what this tribe had to say back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And so my work is based on the anthropological studies that these anthropologists produced. But the system of symbols is given using what are arguably ancient Egyptian words that went out of use around 750 BC. So we know as a starting point that it's at least as old as 750 BC. But there's other evidence when we compare. It looks like as if the Dogon at one time had very close contact with the ancient Egyptians. And when we compare what practices the Dogon have as opposed to what practices we knew the Egyptians had, it keeps pointing to a very early relationship. It's like at the sort of the boundary between the start of dynastic Egypt and pre-dynastic times before that, so around 3000 BC. So sort of out of the gate, we know we're talking about a system that's at least that old.
3000 BC, 3000, so 5000 years old.
Right.
Okay, so what you're saying is, according to African Dogon teachings and Egyptian teachings, the secrets of the universe and atoms and molecules is 5,000 years old.
And yes, and so one of the questions, of course, is how could that possibly be?
Okay, answer that question.
what I've got to do in my field of study is probably the biggest threat to my field of study is the tendency of the human brain to see patterns where they don't really exist.
Right.
And so there's this constant effort to try to filter out my own wishfulness from what is actually the symbolism of these symbols.
Right.
And so one of the rules I make is that all of the interpretations begin with what the cultures themselves flatly say.
Mm-hmm.
What they say is, you know, as you get to the bottom of this tradition in multiple societies, you'd expect somebody would say, oh, we remember when our ancestor Phil invented this and passed it down to his son.
Mm-hmm.
You never bump up against that. What you always bump up against is the idea that someone who knew a lot more about these subjects than we did in ancient times taught this to us.
Okay.
And so you have traditions all over the world of civilizing skills and civilizing concepts having been instructed or provided as sort of a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Even in ancient Egypt, there's an explicit tradition that says their written language was given to them by their gods.
Right.
There's a tradition that says that the plan of the Giza Plateau where the pyramids are, quote-unquote, fell from the sky, whatever that means.
Okay.
Imagine a crop circle, you know?
Right.
So as we compare these things, and we get down to the bottom in each of these cultures, they're all saying essentially the same thing. Somebody who knew a lot more about this stuff than we do taught us this stuff a long time ago.
A long, long time ago. All right?
Yes.
Boy, you know, Native Americans use petroglyphs or rock carvings to depict their daily life. And some of them could be construed as alien beings or humanoid beings in spacesuits and that type of thing. Do you find any of that in these Egyptian hieroglyphs?
You do find a little of that, but that's not really where my studies are coming from. There's a sort of a more direct way of getting at it. I have two symbolic systems here that are a very close match for each other, but they're given in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
One's in Sanskrit, and the other one's in ancient Egyptian words. And so the chance, it's not a very good chance that one culture just adopted it wholesale from the other because they're using entirely different words. But the Sanskrit system, which is Buddhist, was documented by about 400 BC, and the Dogon system is given in words that are at least 750 BC. Now, the two systems are still a match today. We're talking about living religions or living traditions that we can compare how they're understood today to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And these two systems are still a match today, which implies that over thousands of years, somehow both groups managed to keep the system straight since at least 400 BC.
Right.
Now, the problem is that both groups flatly say they got it from somebody who wasn't human. The Buddhists flatly claim that their most sacred symbols came from a non-human source. The Buddhists say it was non-human, but they go a little bit further than that. They actually say it was also non-material originally in sort of a complicated way. There are overt material expressions of how this was presented, but they're saying that originally the mythic teachers they had who presented it were non-material. Now, as a researcher, there's really only two stands I can take towards that. I can postulate that both groups managed to keep every last detail of their tradition straight for thousands and thousands of years, and then both somehow misremembered in matching ways where they got it from. Or I can say they kept every detail straight, including where they got it from, in which case I have to at least allow the possibility that there was some kind of an interaction with a non-human somebody.
Non-human somebody. And did these non-humans fall from the sky? Is that what you're saying, or is that what they're saying?
No, they're not. They're not really saying that. When you get down to the philosophies that are even earlier than Buddhism, there are philosophies that philosophies of a creation that that predate the Vedic tradition, the Buddhist and the Hindu traditions. This goes back very far. This goes back before written language. But in those traditions, the understanding is that universes come in pairs. They come in, and those pairs consist of one that's material, like our universe, and one that's non-material. And so when the Dogen are talking about a non-material teacher, the outlook in these philosophies is that the non-material side has perfect knowledge but an inability to act, and the material side has imperfect knowledge but full ability to act. And so the suggestion is that at some point in time, there was crossover between this, the non-material and the material universe, and somebody decided to give us sort of a helping hand upward in terms of civilizing skills. That apparently, it sounds like they taught agriculture and stonemasonry and animal husbandry and weaving and written language and all sorts of basic civilizing timekeeping concepts, things like that. And culture after culture says the same thing. You go to China and they say it. You go to Tibet and they say it. You go to Africa and they say it. You go to Egypt and they say it. And my work has been sort of comparing how they say it and demonstrating that they're using the same symbols and the same words, basically, understood in the same way to express how this instructed system worked.
All right. Well, similar to spoken language, you know, it's utterances that, you know, that mean the same thing, but you're uttering a different sound. You know what I'm saying?
Right, or sometimes the same sound. Now,
yeah.
I have certain advantages. A linguist would look at this and they'd say, well, there are only about 40 sounds that any language is trying to represent, so the chances are pretty high that you're going to have coincidental matches, that two languages are going to express the same word the same way.
Well, definitely.
Well, in my case, the way this system of symbols of creation, symbols and words of creation is put together, words don't carry just one meaning. They carry multiple meanings. They carry sort of a cluster of meanings. And those meanings are, they're distinct from one another, so that knowing the first meaning doesn't reasonably let you guess the second meaning. So when I go from language to language or culture to culture, I'm not comparing one word and one sound. I'm comparing a word and a sound that has multiple meanings to a similar word with the same sound that has the same set of multiple meanings in another language. And that gives me enough points of comparison to argue that it's not coincident.
Okay, so we're dealing there with sounds, hence language, but comparing, going back to cosmology, which are the symbols, correct?
Right.
Okay, we're talking like Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Dogon symbols. How do they compare?
Well, now the Dogon don't actually have a written language. The Dogon have put priority on an original tradition, which was oral. It was passed down orally. And so in the oral tradition, you have phonetic values that carry meaning.
Okay,
that when they say a certain sound, they mean a certain thing.
But you
and
said,
you go all around the world and see that the same sound means that same thing. I just finished writing a book about the Maori in New Zealand, and I can predict what the Maori words mean based pretty much on the sound of the word. It combines certain sounds together, and based on those combined sounds, it's sort of mixing, matching concepts for me. So now when written language came around 3000 BC, it looks as if certain of these sounds, which are in some cases paired with these cosmological drawings, like the drawing of an electron orbit, the shape and the sound was adopted in the written language along with the meanings that go along with that shape and sound. And so it looks as if this oral tradition was used as the basis for the written language. And it's so consistent that I can positively correlate very early Chinese, ancient Chinese words, right, hieroglyphic words, with corresponding ancient Egyptian words.
Okay, but correct me if I'm mistaken. You said, I believe you said, that the Dogon had to make these pictures, and that the along with their utterances, but
yes,
that they have these pictures to denote what these utterances mean from way back when.
They do, but they don't use that as a written language. They haven't kept any written records with it.
No written records, be it on stone, papyrus.
The only physical objects that can be followed in terms of the Dogon are ritual objects that they make that go along with certain celebrations. For example, there's a 50-year celebration called the Sigi Festival that the Dogon have.
Okay.
And there are certain carved objects that get made with every Sigi Festival that get placed in a cave, and they can count those backwards and from that infer how many sets of 50 years back they had to go to have carved all these things.
All right.
But it doesn't take the form of actual written language. If anything, it's more like a proto-language.
Okay.
It's hard to explain. It's like there are a lot of things happening with these sounds. They're being used to represent things in the daily life of the Dogon.
Okay.
So names of animals will be pronounced in ways that have symbolic significance.
Okay. I need to take just a short break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station that's making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, WHFR.FM, on your computers. And we're speaking with Laird Scranton, cosmologist and researcher, and you're listening to, I'm David Twitchell, you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're talking about the cosmology of everybody, Egyptians and Dogons, and what about the Nazca lines? Do they have anything to do with what you've been studying?
They do. I mean, they're connected. There are cultures down in Peru that are connected to the same tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't made that my focus yet of one of my books, but I know just from what I picked up over the years that there are certain signature, what I call signature signs of this tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that if a culture, well, for example, if a culture used cubits to measure things, we know they came out of the same tradition. If they think that there's a wheel or a chariot associated with Orion, the constellation, we know it's a pretty good guess they came out of the same tradition. There's a whole list of these, what I identify as being signatures. And so I know coming into a culture, I can sit down with a dictionary of a culture I haven't studied before and have a pretty good idea of how much overlap there is with the cultures I've studied.
Okay, now as to the Nazca lines, how do you account for the fact that they didn't know that these pictures existed on the ground until they were until flight? They could see them from the air. There are no mountains up there to go stand up there and look at them. How do you account for that? And yet
that's a very, very, very interesting question, and I don't have a firm theory myself about it. I know a guy who is very talented at finding underground water. He's been hired by villages in Peru to come in and try to find water after teams from Israel have come in and been unable to find water. They'll hire this guy, who's actually a middle school teacher in upstate New York. They hire him to come in, and he successfully finds sources of water.
Hmm.
And he says that the Nazca, these Nazca lines, these drawings of animals that can only be seen from the air,
right,
that in his opinion, they're there to point to where the aquifers are, to where the water sources are. Now, I can't prove or disprove that, but that's his opinion.
Okay, let's examine that. These Nazca lines are there to point to water sources. Okay?
In his opinion, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, these, to me, if I'm going to point to anything, I'll make arrows, you know, or straight lines. Is it coincidence that these lines go around and round and in and out until they make a picture of a monkey, a picture of a scorpion, a picture of an alien-looking being, what we see today in alien mythology as the small grays?
Well, I was taught when I was studying science, my favorite teacher used to say, when you bump up against the third coincidence, when there's the third thing in your study that you have to write off the coincidence, that it's time to consider that something else is going on besides coincidence, something else besides what you understand.
Right, right.
So I can't honestly argue that these pictures of animals that can only be seen from the sky could be coincidental. I don't think they could be.
Yeah, I think the simple version of that is twice is a coincidence, three times is a pattern.
That's right.
Well, I see patterns there, don't you?
Yeah.
And, okay, well, hey, that's the guy's theory on it, okay. But that's a head-scratcher to me. So
now, there are more positive correlations that I can make to South America based on my studies. It looks like at around 3100 BC, around the world in four locations, there was the sudden emergence of agriculturally based kingships associated with lions or large cats, and there's other symbolism that goes with these. But one appeared in Egypt, and the name was Taru. One was in Ireland called Aru. One was in China called Iru, and one was in South America called Peru. And the coincidental emergence of all four of those at basically four different cardinal points. Those names imply basically north, south, east, and west. The names also imply four stages of agriculture. And there's a whole system of symbolism here that ties these sites together. It looks to me like we have a deliberately instructed agriculture that starts to appear around 3100 BC.
Hmm. And this agriculture, of course, was taught to them by...
By their
the
teachers.
Gods?
Now, the non-material teachers, according to the Dogon, these teachers were trying to solve a problem. And the problem was how to minimize the potential bad effects on us of being around them, long-term exposure to them.
Long-term.
And so the way they solved that was they sequestered a group of eight tribes people from a particular group at a remote location, and then instructed those eight, and then sent those eight back to teach everybody else. Well, if we look pretty much anywhere in the world, you find mythic traditions of eight mythic ancestors who come to teach civilizing skills. You see it in South America and Central America. You see it in China. You see it in Africa. You see it all over.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like a sensible statement, but that also implies if there were... potentially bad effects on us from being around them, that implies that whatever non-material source we're talking about had a physical material presence that could affect us.
Well, they would have to have some kind of a physical presence, or we wouldn't be able to see them. In other words, as the Bible talks about the seen and the unseen worlds.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll buy that, but you either see it or you don't. Okay.
Right.
And if
you have
a non-material being coming into our three-dimensional space, I can buy that. Except now I can see you. Now you are physical. Okay. So if you're physical, you're no longer ethereal. Ethereal, I should say. Okay. So now therein lies the rub. If you understand why I'm scratching my head, please advise.
Well,
that's kind of what I said.
That at certain periods of time in our history, it's been possible to cross over between these two paired universes.
Okay.
And at that point is where an instructional contact might have been attempted. The cultures that I'm trace back as far as about 12,000 years ago, just about to the end of the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the Ice Age sort of acts as a block to evidence. It's hard to move beyond that and demonstrate anything in a convincing way. I mean, when you have written texts around 3000 BC, you can point to a text and say, look, this says this, and you can argue that the statement is either correct or that it's not correct. You get before written language, and it starts to be more complicated to try to demonstrate in a convincing way that people thought a certain thing.
Right. Well,
you get to the Ice Age, and it becomes almost impossible to demonstrate what someone's intention was.
Right. Well, even our alphabet is, you know, symbols. Straight lines, short lines, circles, half circles, big and small. Am I correct?
Right. That's right.
Okay, so symbols are symbols. And we make a language out of it, and so did they, okay?
Right. Now, what's interesting is that the cultures that did the best job of preserving this information seem to be the ones that never evolved a written language. In other words, there's something about writing it down that it becomes a crutch.
Right.
It may be that once you've written it down, it absolves you from having to actually understand it or having to remember it as completely. But the cultures that did this was originally an oral tradition. The cultures that preserved it best preserved it orally.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I would have to disagree with their logic there. It's more like the game of telephone or gossip. I tell you a story, you tell somebody else a story, they tell somebody else a story. By the time it gets back to me, it's completely screwed.
Right. Well, see, I'm in a position where I have half a dozen different ways to demonstrate that that didn't happen in this case.
Okay.
I've got Dogon words where the priests today know what the word means and how they pronounce it. And I can compare that to ancient Egyptian words that were written down and inscribed and are now in the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionaries, where these modern scholars think they know what the word, how it was pronounced, and they have a pretty good idea of what the word meant, but we also know for sure what symbols it was written with. Well, the way these Egyptian words work, the symbols represent concepts from my point of view.
Mm.
And I'll give you an example. There's a simple Egyptian word for a week, meaning like the days of a week, and it's written with two glyphs. The first is the sun glyph, which is a circle with a dot, and the second is an upside-down U that's the number 10. Now, I looked at that word, and that Egyptian word, and I said, symbolically, that says to me 10 days, because I know the sun glyph can represent the concept of a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some research, and I discovered ancient Egyptians had a 10-day week.
Mm.
So the form of the word explained its meaning to me before I even knew they had a 10-day week.
Okay.
Now you go to China, and in their earliest written language, the word for week is written with the sun glyph and the number 10, and they had a 10-day week. These are positively synchronized systems of languages. They work the same way as each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once I realized that, then I asked the question, okay, if one word works that way, what are the chances that any other words also work the same way?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out all the cosmological words work that way. That I can go to a written Egyptian word and its symbols explain to me what the meaning of the word is.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I can take the Dogon definition of a word and look at the Egyptian word that's pronounced like it, and check the symbols, and the symbols verify that the Dogon definition hasn't changed. Now, I also have comparable systems of cosmology between the Dogon and the Buddhist in different languages. And when the Dogon say that they understand the meaning of, say, the concept of ascension in a certain way, I can go to Buddhism and see how they understand it, and see that they both understand it the same way. There hasn't been a telephone effect here. These two groups have managed to keep this stuff straight.
Okay. But you see where I'm coming from. If it's just word of mouth, then it can lose meaning somewhere along the way. But if it's written down, well, there's only one meaning.
Allegedly.
Now, one way that they avoided losing meaning was the system was a very mnemonic system. I'll give you an example of that. When my wife and I were raising our kids, and they were too young to read or write, and we would go out to a county fair with them, and we thought, well, what happens if somehow we get separated from one of our children at a county fair? How are they going to ever tell anybody where they live or who they're related to?
Mm-hmm.
And so we taught them to sing their address and their phone number to children's melodies.
Really?
And so when someone said, where do you live? They automatically sang back their address. And when they asked them, what's your phone number? They automatically sang back their phone number. Now, any of our friends who've heard us tell the story and we've sung the song to still remember our address and phone number just by singing the song to themselves.
Of course.
Well, this system worked that same way. It was a very self-reinforcing system.
Right.
It was designed in a way so that when a Dogon tribesperson walked out of their hut and saw certain animals doing certain things, or as they pay attention to how they're weaving a cloth or plowing a field or whatever, these processes were taught to them in ways that self-reinforced the instructed meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes almost impossible to lose the meaning when you have that degree of self-reinforcement happening just culturally.
That's right. There's many, many things that we, lyrics from songs from when we were teenagers, kids, small kids. We can rattle them right off, melody, lyrics, you know. So
yes,
that's a good system.
I'll give you another example. The average person, if I ask them what they would say an owl symbolizes, most people say it symbolizes knowledge. And I point out to them that this is symbolism that's 5,000 years old. Did they realize that?
Mm-hmm.
That symbolism is so tenacious that a meaning that was assigned to an image 5,000 years ago, they still remember what it means.
Right. That's right. And many people have claimed to have seen strange-looking symbols on or inside of UFOs, likening them to Egyptian hieroglyphics. What do you think the reason for that is?
Well, this is. I have a very interesting perspective on this. You know, I mentioned that there are multiple themes, creational themes that these symbols relate to. So any symbol has... you can't just ask, what does this symbol mean? You have to ask, what does it mean in relation to the theme, a particular theme?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are also four levels of meaning to the Dogon drawings. Every Dogon drawing, you have to state which of four levels of perspective this drawing is representing. And so on one level of understanding, these four perspectives on the drawing are dimensional. The sort of the classic metaphor for how these work is the first is the building of a house. Like, it's really more connects to the idea of laying out an architectural drawing.
Mm-hmm.
The first stage is to place the endpoints of the structure you're about to build. The next phase is to flesh that out with some additional points in between the endpoints. The third phase is to connect those points with lines, and the fourth phase is to actually build the thing. And there's a name to each of these four stages. Now, one of the critical structures of matter that forms, this is long before an atom, this is like the first coherent structure that Dogon say gets created, we see as a spiral. But that's only one view of the drawing. If you go the next level down, the next like dimensional level down of perspective on the drawing, it looks like seven rays of a star coming out from a point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it looks to me as if what they're comparing in many cases is the way something looks to us from four dimensions to the way that the thing looks to somebody who might have been non-material looking at it from a different set of dimensions, say three dimensions.
Three dimensions.
Now, these clusters of meanings of words work sort of the same way. I'll give you an example of how that pertains to UFOs. There's a story about a woman who steps out of her house and sees three small gray aliens on her porch.
Hmm.
And when they become aware of the fact that she's there, they turn to leave suddenly. But as they leave, instead of seeing three gray aliens, she sees three deer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, you discover that the word that means to leave or to depart in haste is a homonym. It's pronounced the same way as a word that means deer. And
really?
So the suggestion is that we're seeing a dimensional translation here that's sort of telepathic. When they think depart, she thinks deer.
Right.
There's
okay.
Another effect that happens that many people have sort of a mask image that appears to them of owls when they've actually had an experience that looks like it's an alien encounter.
Right. Right.
Well, the Egyptian word that means to try to comfort somebody is a homonym for the Egyptian word that means owl. And so if you imagine that the UFO entity on the other side realizes that they are frightening the person who they're encountering and they try to think comforting thoughts, the person sees an owl.
Right.
There's another case where a person saw a group of tall, slender aliens walking across the field and knew instantly that they themselves were going to black out. Well, the Egyptian word for faint is a homonym for a word that means to approach with caution. And so I see a sort of symbolic translation that's dimensional happening here with these UFO contacts, where some of these recurring images that people see relate to the things that the non-humans are ostensibly doing.
All right. I want to touch on that some more, but I need to take another moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is a station making waves, and it is 89.3 FM on your radio. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and we're speaking with cosmologist and researcher Mr. Laird Scranton. And back to this owl and deer. There's one case that I know I've mentioned this before, where this alleged abductee remembers seeing a 3-foot owl, 3 foot high.
Right.
Now, to him, this was all right because it was an owl. This was logical, even though it was 3 foot tall. It was
right,
an owl.
And even though there are no known species of owls that are that large.
That's right. But he would rather believe that he had seen a 3 foot owl than believe that he had seen a 3 foot alien gray, you know?
Right.
And another case where, and this has happened again and again with the deer, a case where a couple of man and his daughter are driving and talking about her. She's about to graduate and go on to college, and they're talking about this, and all of a sudden, the entire world goes pixelizing, you know what I'm saying? Pixelization, and then it comes back, the world comes back into focus. They're on a road that is 6 miles from where they were, and they're going down this road, and it's lined with deer on either side just watching them drive by. And to them, this is perfectly logical that deer, a bunch of deer, would stand there at roadside, not being spooked by the car, just standing there watching them go by.
Right.
You know? So, same thing. So, there is that connection. The owl, the deer, and what do we call screen memories.
That's right.
Right. So...
So part of what I do when I encounter a case like this, when someone talks to me about a UFO situation, is that I try to focus on what the image is that the person saw that seemed abnormal, and then compare that to what the Egyptian multiple meanings of that sound are.
Okay.
The sound that represents that word has other meanings. And in most cases, I'm discovering that there's a connection or a potential connection between... what they thought they saw and what they might have actually been seeing.
All right. So not so much the owl and the deer, but going back to the symbols on the outside and inside of the UFO, it's logical that these symbols to some other civilization have a meaning. They're words, just like the Egyptians, the Dogon symbols, the any symbols, Oriental, the Chinese, and our symbols, our ABCs. You know, what's
right.
the, what's the difference between, you know, that can't be, that can't, well, UFOs can't be to some people, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, people have the limits of what they are going to accept and what they're not.
Right.
In my field of study, that probably the first thing a person learns is that there are things going on that we can't explain yet.
Right.
And just I compare science, which I like science very much, but I compare the perspective of a scientist of a traditional scientist to the person who gets in their car and makes the rule for themselves that from now on they're only going to accept as real the things they see out the windshield and in the mirrors of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anyone who's driven for a while comes to realize that there's a blind spot there. The blind spot is large enough to hide a tractor trailer.
Mm-hmm.
If you only accept as real the things you see in the mirrors and out the windshield, you're going to miss what's in the blind spot. And there are actually ways of demonstrating that these blind spots exist for science. There's when we get to talk about fundamental particles of matter, these particles are grouped. There are a couple of hundred of them, but they're grouped by symmetry, which is basically the way they look from as you turn them around. There's one that looks the same from all sides, one kind of particle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a category of particles that don't look the same unless you turn them halfway around.
Mm-hmm.
There's another kind of particle that you have to turn all the way around to look the same. And there's a fourth category of particles that you have to turn around twice to make them look the same.
Really?
And that last category of particles allow the possibility that the particle is passing into a realm that we don't readily perceive.
Right, right. So many things we don't readily perceive. Our visual light perception is so limited, you know?
Right.
And our auditory perception is so limited. 150 years ago, 100 years ago, if you couldn't see it, you couldn't hear it, couldn't experience it with your five senses, it didn't exist.
That's right.
And I always use the analogy, you're listening to this radio show right now, or listening to it on your these radio waves are going out, all right? And if you turn the radio off, please don't do it, but if you turn the radio off, where do these sound waves go? Do they go back into the wall, back to our studio? No, they're still in the air right around you. But
effectively, they don't exist for the person who's not listening.
That's right. It doesn't exist because you turn the radio off.
Well, another analogy similar to that I give, imagine you start out on a car trip across country.
Mm-hmm.
And before you go, you set your car radio to your favorite station in your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you drive across the country and you move into and out of broadcast zones, it looks to you as if that radio stations are coming into and out of existence.
Right.
The truth of the matter is they exist the whole time. You're only perceiving them when you happen to be in a receptive area.
Right. That's right. So let me ask you this. Do you see a connection between crop formations and other symbols found around the world?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the work that I do is very comparable to what crop circles are. Crop circles, in the end, for me, are come down to a parlor trick.
Mm-hmm.
This is hard to explain. But one of the effects that witnesses to crop circles forming report is a high twittering sound. Now, some of the witnesses actually were able to record that sound and have it analyzed, and they discovered that the sound was at 15 kilohertz.
Okay, this sound is coming from what?
This is a twittering sound that happens as the crop circle forms.
Oh, as it forms, okay.
Okay, now, disconnected from that, I was reading an article about some botanists who were trying to develop a way to get plants to shake off bugs so that they wouldn't be eaten by the bugs. and they were using lasers to induce what are called flexural waves that cause the plant stalk to shake back and forth.
Hmm.
And they discovered that when the frequency of that flexural wave hits 15 kilohertz, the plant bends just like a crop circle.
Hmm.
The plant's still living. It's bent. It's not damaged. But it's bent over just the same way a crop circle is. Now, realizing this, that there's a certain frequency of energy that can cause that to happen, you can imagine that anybody with access to a satellite and a basic PC and basically printer technology, instead of being attached to ink, being attached to lasers, could pick any image they wanted off the Internet and print it in a field.
Hmm.
This is essentially a parlor trick. The thing that makes it interesting is it started happening. The first ones were reported about 1500 AD, which is way before any computer should be around.
Right.
And the sequence of shapes that they're choosing to present often represent sort of, from my perspective, insider knowledge about how certain geometry works as processes of creation happen.
Right.
This is not information that just your average person would know to pick this image.
Right. That's right. So there's many things that the skeptic can point to, to show this parlor trick, so to speak. But when you ask them to go ahead and recreate this.
Yes.
Some of them you can. I mean, some of them are man-made. I'll give you that. But there are certain ones that you go in, and what I think is so interesting is in a genuine crop formation, you can go in with a device that, I forget what the name of the device is now, but shows you where you are as to above or below sea level.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
You go in, let's say, you've got a flat surface, a flat field, and you are 100 feet above sea level, and then you go into that crop formation, and all of a sudden you are 20 feet below sea level, then 20 feet above sea level, you get to the center of that crop formation, and your dial is spinning, and it doesn't know what the heck you're doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that...
Yep. No, I know a real crop circle has certain features that make it unique. I mean,
right.
First of all, the plants are typically not damaged. They're bent, but they're still growing. And if you
right.
let them continue to grow, they will.
Right.
In a man-made crop circle, typically there's damage to the stalks,
right.
and many of them won't grow.
Right.
There are electromagnetic effects that have been reported for real crop circles. Helicopters are warned not to fly directly above a crop circle because there have been cases where they crash because the electronics of the helicopter fail.
Right. So are there any crop formations that you're familiar with that resemble or are identical to Egyptian hieroglyphics or Dogon symbols or any other?
So far, my field of study hasn't been specifically with crop circles, but I have noticed, as they're reported in the media, that there are shapes that are being created there that I relate to the stages of the cosmologies I study.
Hmm.
I haven't seen any that spell out a particular message or anything. That it's more as if we have... Well, one of the things that Dogon said was that one of the goals of their teachers was the intention to draw humanity to civilization like a moth is drawn to a flame. That one of the purposes of these crop circles is to get us to scratch our heads and go, huh? And to start thinking about, could there be things going on that we're not paying attention to?
Right, right. Well, that's the sign of a true scientist that says, I don't know everything. I always say if science knew everything there was to know, they could just write a book and go sell shoes,
<That's->
So... let me ask you this. Do you see a connection? Oh, I've already asked you that. I got my questions written down. I'm cheating over here.
That's all right.
Are there any ancient symbols that have been interpreted by mainstream scholars that could be alternatively interpreted to have a ufological connotation?
Yes, actually, that's very commonly true, that the traditional outlook on what a symbol represents isn't necessarily what it represents. More frequently, it's a situation where, when you look at the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionaries, they have a pretty good handle on what the word means. What they don't have a handle on is why it means what it means. And that's what study of groups like the Dogon help us to get down to the interpretation of why does this particular set of symbols represent the concept that the Egyptologist says that it represents. And it's it works sort of like a rebus puzzle of a child, where you have a picture, a set of pictures that really represent a sentence, okay, or represent syllables of a word. With the Egyptian words, I substitute concepts for symbols and produce a symbolic sentence, and that sentence tells me what the word means. But more than that, there are certain Egyptian words where there's a trailing glyph beyond that that doesn't get pronounced, that the word, I can see that the purpose of the word is to define that trailing glyph. Now, when you understand this, then you can start laying out a long list of Egyptian hieroglyphs, hieroglyphic characters, whose meanings you understand because Egyptian words told you what they meant, not because some Dogon priest says, I think it means this.
Okay, but that deals with Egyptian and Dogon. But what about ufological connotations? In other
Same thing. The when we're talking about teachers bringing civilizing skills, okay, it looks to me that in very ancient times, there are certain influences that are global, that there was an attempt globally to teach the same skills in the same way, and that one of the reasons that Carl Jung finds archetypical symbols carrying the same meanings from culture to culture is not because they evolved in one place and sort of migrated with the populace to all the other places. It's because there was a deliberate instructional effort where students were brought to a remote site and taught these concepts and sent back to try to establish things where they lived.
Okay.
So it would be as if you and I had the same math teacher in different years in high school, and we meet at a party, and we discover we have all the same references and all the same formulas and all the same cute little stories about math, not because you or I ever met each other, but because we had the same teacher.
Ah. And that teacher would be?
That teacher would be these, from the Dogon perspective, would be these non-material, knowledgeable, mythic teachers who somehow managed to materialize and help us.
And you get that same claim about Egyptian hieroglyphics and Egyptian teachers?
It's all the same stuff. Where the Dogon define stages of creation that look scientific, the Dogon have taken each of those concepts and stages and anthropomorphized it. Mm-hmm. And they've turned it into a deity. There is one perspective on symbolism that relates to animals, and there's a specific progression where early stages of creation relate to insects, and then to fish, and then to four-legged animals, and then to birds. When you look at Egyptian deities who have animal heads, you discover that the symbolism of the deity can be predicted based on which head they have.
Ah.
That creational stages that are later in the process, the guy has the head of a bird. In the earlier stages, it's the head of an insect.
Yeah. We're kind of running out of time, Laird, but where can our listeners go to find more about your work?
Well, Googling Laird Scranton turns up a lot. I have an author page at simonandschuster.com and at innertraditions.com.
Okay.
My books can be acquired pretty much anywhere. Amazon has them. Any bookstore can either has a book in stock or can order one. Pretty easily available. If they want to reach me personally, there is a lairdscranton.com that's a fan site, and the contact tab there does reach me. But I'm probably most accessible through Facebook. A person can message me on Facebook, or they can friend me on Facebook, and I'd be happy to answer questions for people.
Very good. Laird Scranton, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, and that's UFOImplications.com. UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Yo, guys and dolls out there. You're at the Malt Shop with Daddy G here on WHFR.FM, the station that's making the waves. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s today, like we do every Tuesday at the Malt Shop. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop, where our jukeboxes are playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
To get that swing, past 16, just been kissed, graduated and got that twist, the kind of love you can't resist. At 17, now sloppy shirt, old blue jeans, dirty shoes, by all means, patch of blonde, rock side hair, jukebox baby, ain't no square. 17, she's a queen, cutest gal you've ever seen. All the boys are really keen on the hep cat doll of 17.